I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this last day of April, the 30th, and we're going to be talking about the very beginning of the universe this hour of the program. The Planck satellite, which was launched in 2009 and has been scanning the sky ever since that time, had a major picture released late in March, and it is of microwaves detected by Planck that date from 370,000 years after the Big Bang. What they found is pretty remarkable. Our guest this hour says that the Planck release is Cosmology's Human Genome Project, showing the seeds from which the current universe grew. This hour of the program, we're going to be speaking with an astrophysicist who commented on the work of Planck at a news teleconference that was sponsored by NASA late in the month of March. Mark Kaminowski is an astrophysicist at Johns Hopkins University, professor of physics and astronomy. Professor Kaminowski is a theoretical physicist who specializes in cosmology and particle physics, and his work has been on the hypothesis that some new elementary particle may constitute the cosmological dark matter. All of you space enthusiasts and astrophysicists among us, we particularly welcome your phone calls as we talk about this remarkable discovery. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, if you'd like to use that, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Kaminowski, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to join you.
Yeah, pleasure to have you with us. Why don't we start with this Planck satellite, what it was launched to do, and essentially what it is they gave us late in March.
The Planck satellite was launched by the European Space Agency in collaboration with NASA to measure the cosmic microwave background across the sky. So if you look at the night sky with the naked eye, you see a whole bunch of stars. If you look at the night sky with a powerful telescope, you'll see a whole bunch of galaxies, which are sort of like stars, but sort of a bit more diffuse. But most of the sky is dark. It's black. You don't see anything. The things that you see are tiny little dots on top of it. However, if your eyes operated at radio frequencies, the electromagnetic spectrum, rather than at optical frequencies, then the entire sky would glow. You would see that the entire sky is glowing. And that glow is actually left over, the decaying embers, in some sense, of the Big Bang, from which our universe began. So the Planck satellite was launched to measure very small fluctuations in this cosmic microwave background with very, very high precision.
So that glow that was left over from the Big Bang is really old.
It's really, really old. It's as old as anything that we can see in the universe.
Goodness.
It's about 13.8 billion years old.
Whoa! And they were able to discover this because of the sophistication of the camera here? Or how were they able to discover this?
Oh, the discovery is actually an interesting story. It actually occurred quite a bit before my time, so I've heard stories about it, which I will now repeat.
Okay.
It actually was discovered as by two scientists working at Bell Labs in the early to mid-1960s. You know, now we all have cable TV, but those of us who remember what TVs looked like before you had cable, you know, when you tuned the TV to a channel that wasn't broadcasting, you get a whole bunch of snow on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
So roughly one-tenth of the snow that you would see on the TV is actually this cosmic microwave background radiation. And the scientists at Bell Labs were, you know, trying to make better radio receivers. They were trying to eliminate noise in the receivers, and they found some noise that they couldn't track down to anything else. And the story is that they were down the road from Princeton University, and there were some astrophysicists at Princeton University who they consulted with who told them that that is the cosmic microwave background, the afterglow left over from the Big Bang that had been hypothesized or predicted roughly 20 years earlier by several physicists.
Oh, my. That is quite a story. Now, the picture also shows, tell me how this happens, that the universe is older than we thought it was, and it's also fatter than we thought it was. What does that mean?
So the universe turns out to be a little bit older than we thought it was by about 100 million years. The Planck satellite is actually following up on another satellite that was launched by NASA about 10 years ago called the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, named actually for David Wilkinson, one of the Princeton University professors who told these guys from Bell Labs what it is that they're seeing. What happens is that the satellites measure very, very tiny fluctuations in this cosmic microwave background. So when you look at one point on the sky, it's glowing with some brightness. When you look at some other point on the sky, it's glowing with some other brightness. And those two brightnesses are about the same to roughly one part in 100,000. So they're very, very, very close to the same everywhere in the sky. But there are tiny fluctuations in the brightnesses that you see. And by comparing the observed amplitude of those fluctuations with detailed models for the origin of this cosmic microwave background, we can sort of determine the age of the universe. And the age that Planck is getting is about 100 million years older than the age that WMAP was getting, and that's primarily because Planck is a slightly more sensitive and precise experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that, you know, 100 million years sounds like a lot of time, and it is a lot of time. But from the point of view of a cosmologist like myself, it's not such a big deal. You know, before it might have been 13.7 billion years, now it's 13.8 billion years. So from our point of view, it's as if, you know, I were to ask you, how old is your grandfather? And you would say, he's 102 years old. And I would say, wow, that's old.
Mm-hmm.
You'd say, oh, no, sorry, I made a mistake. He's 101 years old.
Oh.
I'd still say, wow, he's old. Now, you know, if you said he's 102 years old, I said, wow, he's 102 years old. He said, oh, no, sorry, he's 72 years old. I'd say, oh, that's a different story. He's still, you know, a young man.
Right, right. The other thing that the news reports on this say is that what we saw offered support for the notion of inflation, which has been the backbone of the Big Bang theorizing for a number of years now. What is inflation?
Inflation is a hypothesis for what set the Big Bang in motion. So we have this model for the evolution of the universe, and we call it the Big Bang. The universe that we see is expanding. It's getting the galaxies in the universe are getting further apart with time. And if we run, you know, this universe backward in time, what that means is that at earlier times the universe must have been denser. All the galaxies must have been closer and closer together. And the Big Bang is a model that describes this evolution. But something set those galaxies in motion 13.8 billion years ago. Something sort of started, you know, pushing them away from each other. Something got the whole thing going.
Mm-hmm.
And what got it going has been one of the big mysteries in cosmology. The best idea we have for that is this theory called inflation. And inflation is, in some sense, a very simple theory, but in other ways a very complicated theory. It relies on new physics at energy scales far beyond those that we can access in laboratory experiments, but which we believe might actually be there. And it hypothesizes that within the first nanosecond after the Big Bang, there was a period of what we call superluminal expansion, when the universe was in some sense expanding faster than the speed of light and able, therefore, to take a very tiny patch in the early universe and blow it up into the huge universe that we see today. I'm guessing that very little of that made sense.
No, I got it. It makes sense. I can see it happening when you describe it.
So, what was the question?
The question was inflation. What inflation has to do with all of this?
Oh, yeah. So, inflation actually turns out to be, from the point of view of theoretical physics, a simple idea, and sort of an elegant idea, because it made a number of predictions about the precise nature and character of these fluctuations that I talked about in the cosmic microwave background. And the Planck satellite has now measured these fluctuations with exquisite precision. Roughly speaking, they can measure the brightness at each point on the sky that's only a few arc minutes across. So roughly speaking, they've measured the brightness, not of the night sky, but they've measured the brightness at several million different places in the night sky.
So the thing I don't understand is this force, this dark, mysterious force, do we know what that was that, created this explosion?
No, that's the
why
we still have work ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
So inflation, some of my colleagues refer to it as a paradigm rather than a theory. It's sort of an idea that requires certain ingredients from fundamental physics, but we actually don't know where these new ingredients would come from. So high-energy physicists have a number of very intriguing ideas about what may happen at very high energies. Can I do a little detour into the world of particle physics?
You can do whatever you want.
Okay. So in physics, we have several fundamental forces that we know about. There's gravity.
Mm-hmm.
I have a nine-month-old son. He's decided that gravity is the source of all evil. So everybody knows about gravity. There's also electromagnetism. You know, you roll around on the floor when you're wearing an acrylic sweater, and you get static electricity shocks. So that's electromagnetism. Electromagnetism is responsible for just about everything around us. It's responsible for chemistry. It's responsible for holding us together, etc. Then there are also two other forces that we know about. One is called the strong force, and that's what holds protons and neutrons together in atomic nuclei. And then there's the weak force, which sort of plays a secondary role in the actual management of day-to-day life of the atom and molecule. But it's responsible for beta decays of nuclei. And we actually now have a standard model of electroweak interactions. We have one theory that explains the electromagnetic forces and the weak interactions, and that theory works extremely well, and it's being tested as we speak at the Large Hadron Collider, and there are new discoveries being made about the details of how it operates as we speak, but that's understood very well. But then there's the strong interaction, and that's not yet unified with the other two. It looks similar, but it's not the same. But we have reasons to believe, given the similarity, that they're related. You know, if you see a mother walking down the street with two sons, the two sons might look the same or similar.
Mm-hmm.
And their similarity leads you to suggest that they might be related. So your mind does this all the time when you, you know, in regular social interactions, you see relations between people who look similar. Likewise, when we look at the electromagnetic interaction, we look at the strong interactions, the mathematical structures look really, really similar. They look like siblings. And so theorists have hypothesized that there's some overarching parent theory, which we call grand unified theories. Then there are also other theorists who try to unify these three fundamental interactions with gravity. So get all the fundamental interactions together in one theory. And some people call that quantum gravity. Some people call it string theory. Anyway, there are a whole bunch of interesting ideas for different ways to unify the different fundamental interactions that we have. And all of these different ideas can provide some of the elements required for inflation, but we actually don't know what new physics is responsible for inflation.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons why we're so intrigued by it.
And what was it? What was the particle that was inflated? What was the makeup of that?
I wish I knew.
We don't know that.
We call it the inflaton. Because inflaton sounds like inflation, but we really don't know what it is. Some theorists postulate that it's a field called the dilaton, which has something to do with quantum gravity. Other people believe that it's a Higgs field associated with grand unification. You may have read about the discovery of the Higgs boson.
Yes.
At the Large Hadron Collider recently. Mm-hmm. So the Higgs boson is a new particle associated with the breaking of electroweak interactions, the interactions that unify electricity, electromagnetism, and the weak interactions. But there are also additional Higgs bosons postulated that would be associated with the unification of electromagnetism with the strong interactions. So it could be one of those Higgs fields, but then it could be something completely different.
Doesn't it absolutely dumbfound you Or maybe you just operate in a you obviously operate in a different realm than I do. But doesn't it dumbfound you that all that we have, the fact that we're talking about this now, living on this planet with this universe and all these galaxies, goes back to that moment, that this is what happened? Isn't that something?
I do get dumbfounded, but not on a day-to-day basis.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you do this for a living, you wake up in the morning and you do calculations and you look at the data and you do analyses and you spend a lot of time debugging code and trying to make sure the calculations you did are correct. But then every now and then something happens, like the release of the Planck satellite data. And, you know, when I first saw it, it was absolutely stunning and amazing that amazing is a technological feat, but amazing that the theoretical models that we have work so well. So, yeah, I think I am dumbfounded. Mm-hmm. It's pretty spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Or you have a baby, and that's pretty dumbfounding too, right?
That's also pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
In a different way.
Right, in a different way. The other thing that we learned from all of this, I believe, is that the universe, and tell me how significant this may be, is not expanding as rapidly as we thought it was.
So that's actually an interesting result. Whether it's interesting or not remains to be determined, but the fact that it may be interesting is interesting. So there are a number of different ways to measure the rate at which the universe is expanding. And one of the ways to measure the rate is to look at nearby galaxies and just see how fast they're moving away from us. And then there are other ways to measure the expansion rate. One of them is to measure the distribution of galaxies and then try to fit the measure distribution to models that depend on the expansion rate. And then there's the cosmic microwave background. And the cosmic microwave background measures the expansion rate in yet a different way. We have models for the early universe, and those models make predictions for the details of the fluctuations that we see in the cosmic microwave background. And then we look at all of the different models and try to see which model fits the observed fluctuations the best. And that model that fits the observed fluctuations the best says that the expansion rate is a little bit smaller than what people are measuring by direct observations.
Mm.
Now, there are several possible explanations. One is that there may have been a slight error or miscalibration in one of the measurements. Whenever you are talking about forefront science, whenever you're talking about brand new discoveries, you always have to be cautious. These are complicated analyses, and although the team of scientists is outstanding, it's a new instrument. You know, it's like when you get a new car and you step on the gas pedal the first time. If you had if your previous car had a really sensitive gas pedal, then you might have to push harder on the new one to get it going. And if the old car had a pedal that you had to really push hard on, and then you get a new car that's got a very sensitive gas pedal, you might go through the garage wall.
Right.
So likewise, when you have a new satellite, when you have a new experiment, it sometimes takes some time to understand precisely how it's working. So one possibility is that one of the measurements may have been slightly off, slightly miscalibrated. But another possibility is that the reason the two measurements disagree is because there's something going on in the universe that our models do not yet account for. And one of them is that the cosmological constant, or the dark energy that's driving the cosmic expansion to accelerate, may be behaving in a slightly more subtle way than we may have previously thought.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we have one line open now. The rest of our lines are filled, so take it if you would like. We're talking this hour about this remarkable discovery. It came from the Planck satellite just at the end of March. The satellite was launched in the year 2009, and it has given us some striking images of the universe shortly after the Big Bang. It's like 370,000 years, which sounds like a long time, but when you look at a 13 billion year old universe, this is just, you know, a matter of seconds, really. So we're talking about what those have told us about what happened right after the Big Bang, and perhaps gets us a step closer to finding out the whole thing, how the whole thing happened. And our guest is an astrophysicist. His name is Professor Mark Kamienkowski. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at Johns Hopkins University, and he was at the teleconference sponsored by NASA after this discovery by Planck, calling this cosmology's Human Genome Project, showing the seeds from which the current universe grew. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A couple of things to tell you. First, the president is having a press conference, which is airing right now. It was unscheduled. He's taking questions from reporters, and we're not carrying this live, but if you would like to go to WPR.org to hear what the president says, you can do that. Second thing is, hour two of our program today, we're all getting older, and a lot of us are thinking that we don't want to think about getting older, and as a result, we have an uncertain future and perhaps a problematic future, underestimating the cost of nursing homes, overestimating what Medicare will cover, not setting aside money to prepare for what happens to us when we get ill, and most of us will need some kind of long-term care for at least 3 years once we're older. So we'll talk about that issue, hour two of our show. To your phone calls now, let's go to Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, Mark and Kathleen. This just makes my brain buzz.
Mine too, Jeff. Yeah.
I actually had a question all set, but then when Mark starts talking about particle physics, it just kind of makes it veer a little bit. So my veering question is, as I understand it, everything that we know about in the universe is made up of two little quarks called up and down quarks, and a lepton called an electron, and everything we know, because you put those together and you make everything we see in the universe. And the only contact we have with stuff is through the gauge particle for electromagnetism, the photon. That's the only way we have to communicate with atoms. Now, the weird thing is we've got this stuff called dark matter, which we know does not interact with photons. And that's why it's dark. My question is, and this isn't what I originally called in about, but you've made me think of this, is we've got weird other quarks that aren't doing anything. We've got charm and strange, and then they've got the muon that is their lepton, and they've got top and bottom, and the tau. Could these guys be forming up and making matter that doesn't have a photon as a gauge particle to talk to each other? And that's the only reason why it's dark, and we're looking at something that the standard model already knows about. We just are not looking for the right gauge particle.
So that's actually a great question. So one of the fundamental principles of physics is that it's supposed to be economical. Any explanation you make for any physical phenomenon should be the most economical possible, the one that requires the least new tooth fairies to be invoked. So you're correct. Before we start talking about, you know, dark matter being some kind of new supersymmetric particle or axion, we should look at all the particles that we know to exist and see whether any of those could make up the dark matter. So in addition to the electron and proton and neutron that make up atomic nuclei, as you pointed out, there are many other particles. There are muons, there are tauons. There are four other quarks in addition to the up and down quarks that make up the proton and neutron, charm, strange, top, and bottom. So it turns out that all of these additional particles are unstable. As soon as they're produced, they decay immediately. And the universe is 13.8 billion years old. So whatever particle is making up the dark matter, it has to be very, very stable. It has to be very long-lived. And so none of those particles fits the bill. There are also neutrinos. There are several types of neutrinos. There's a neutrino associated with the electron, which we call the electron neutrino. There's a neutrino associated with the muon, which we call a muon neutrino. and a neutrino associated with the tau lepton, which we call the tau neutrino. And these neutrinos, we are pretty sure, do exist. They were produced in the Big Bang. But the models we have suggest that there just aren't enough of them to make up the dark matter. Their contribution to the mass density of the universe is just too small. So we have to have something else out there.
So okay, my brain is still buzzing.
Are you an astrophysicist too, Jeff?
That's as good as... Excuse me?
Are you an astrophysicist as well?
Well, actually, no, but I happen to, just by accident, run the state 4-H astronomy project, so I'm an astronomy wannabe.
Wonderful. Well, you seem to be pretty well informed. Thank you.
You gave an excellent description of the standard model. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks much.
Okay,
bye.
Renee in Shorewood. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I feel rather stupid based on the previous caller.
It's all right.
But, I understand that it hasn't been too long since astrophysicists and astronomers have known about white holes or speculated on them. And what I was wondering is it conceivable that from other universes where black holes are sucking up mass and energy, that they reach critical mass and literally explode that mass into a new universe, creating Big Bangs all over the place, and that invisible particular mass creates vortices and currents in the energy that starts forming the various, particles that come together and make planets and stuff like that? I mean, is that possible?
I would say almost anything is possible. Whether it happens or not is another question. So I don't think that the things that you suggested are going on. So it is true that there are black holes throughout our universe. They are what happens to many stars after they've used up their nuclear fuel. They turn into black mm-hmm. holes. There are also supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies. The origin of those is still a bit of a mystery to us, although we sort of have ideas about where they come from. And there is something that we don't understand that happens at the center of the black holes. There's something mm-hmm. called a singularity. Anything that falls into a black hole is going to wind up at the center of the black hole and wind up at infinite density.
Yeah.
And our theoretical models don't really tell us what happened infinite density. They sort of break down. So we can describe everything about the black hole with confidence, except what happens precisely at the center. So there are some people who have hypothesized that the centers of those black holes do give rise to big bangs, do create universes.
Kind of like an hourglass.
Yeah. So it's conceivable that what we call the Big Bang may have been the singularity at the center of a black hole for some other universe.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get that to work from the point of view of a theoretical physicist is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So what we try to do is actually come up with mathematical models for the things that we, for the notions we describe, for example, like you did with words. And
unfortunately, I'm an artist, so I think visually, and I do not have any math to speak of that would even fit that. But it just seems so logical that, you know, you have all of this tremendous amount of force in an infinitely small spot, and it's going to reach a point where it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, it's not at all an unreasonable idea.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, some of my colleagues in theoretical physics have thought about this. And it's conceivable. The issue is that someone needs to develop a mathematical model that will describe it consistent with our notions or knowledge of fundamental laws of physics, and then see whether the mathematical model makes predictions for things like the cosmic microwave background that we've now measured very precisely.
Thanks, Renee, very much for the call. Can you tell me, Professor, a little more about the minds who have been working on this, the people who put together Planck? Is this an international project by astrophysicists? Is it European mostly?
Oh, the Planck satellite is an international collaboration. It's led primarily by the European Space Agency, but there was also active participation from NASA. There are, I don't remember the exact number, but roughly 500, an order of 500 scientists involved.
Oh.
It's possibly the biggest collaboration we've had in cosmology so far. There's a very strong team from France. There's a very strong team from Italy. There's very strong contributions from England. The project leadership some of the leadership is in the Netherlands. There are Spanish astrophysicists involved, a very strong German contribution to the project, and there was also a very strong contribution from the United States, primarily from JPL and Caltech.
Mm. So all of this research is continuing. It's an ongoing project?
Yeah. Wait, can you ask that question again?
Is the research continuing? Is Planck going to take pictures of something else, and are all the scientists continuing to cooperate?
Oh, yeah. So this, the satellite was designed with some special cooling system. In order for the instruments to operate, they had to be at very cold temperatures. And there's some refrigerant that's involved to keep them at cold temperatures that doesn't last forever. So the satellite actually has a finite lifetime of only a few years. It's still taking data. The data that was analyzed for the press conference last month is only a fraction of the data. So they still have more data to analyze. There will still be more new results announced sometime next year, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've seen is, I won't say it's the tip of the iceberg, but it's not the whole enchilada yet.
Mm-hmm. Anna in Harbor Springs, Michigan is next. Hi, Anna.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm afraid it may be a little far afield. I'm going to bring you back down to Earth for a minute and ask you what it is about the birth of this planet that gave it its unique atmosphere that is different from other planets. Can you explain that in a understandable way?
That is something I don't know. So there's actually been a huge progress in astronomy the past 15 years in our understanding of how planets form, primarily because of the discovery of roughly 1,000 planets orbiting other stars. But that is not my field, and I really don't know much about how the solar system formed. One of the things I actually find kind of curious as a cosmologist is that, the Earth, as you say, is where we live. We have we see it all the time. We've been observing it for thousands of years in detail. And the Sun, we've been observing for a long time. And the solar system we've seen for a very, very long time. And we have detailed observations. We now have satellites that have traveled throughout the solar system. And what is kind of remarkable to me as a cosmologist is that we actually now have a more robust and quantitative and detailed model of the origin of the universe as a whole than we do of our own solar system. So I can't answer your question primarily because I'm not an expert, but even if I was an expert on solar system formation and the formation of the Earth, I'd still probably have trouble answering your question with confidence.
Hmm. Thank you, Anna, for the call. Mike in Madison, hi. Mike?
Yeah, I'm just kind of a casual observer of physics, but it seems to me that the more we discover, the more perplexing the universe becomes. And I was wondering if there is an avenue of inquiry that you see some resolution, or if the next answer is going to raise another multitude of questions forever.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? I don't think I...
Yeah, the phone isn't great. Let me just give you the first part of it. As we learn more, it would appear that the universe is getting more complicated. Is that indeed the truth?
Yes, the universe is, in fact, getting more complicated. It's closely related to the arrow of time and fundamentals of thermodynamics. entropy, according to the fundamental laws of thermodynamics, is always increasing. So the universe is, in fact, getting more complicated with time. At the time that the cosmic microwave background was formed, the universe was actually relatively simple. It was very smooth. It looked the same everywhere. And over time, things have evolved to become more complicated. There are galaxies. There are clusters of galaxies. There are structures on larger scales. There are dwarf galaxies. There are stars. There are things called globular clusters. There are solar systems. There are planets. And there are people like you and me. So definitely things are getting much more complicated.
Hmm. You mentioned that this is the beginning of data that's being analyzed. Do we know the nature of the other data that's being analyzed from Planck?
Yes, we do. So what I told you so far is that the Planck satellite has measured the fluctuations in the brightness with which the sky glows. But if you look at something that's composed of electromagnetic radiation or light, there's another property in addition to how bright it is, and that other property is the polarization. So if you wear Polaroid sunglasses, the next time you go to an ATM machine, put on your Polaroid sunglasses and then turn your head 45 degrees and you'll see that the screen disappears.
Oh.
And the reason that occurs is because the Polaroid sunglasses only allow one polarization of light to pass through, and most ATM machines actually emit polarized light. So in addition to measuring the brightness of the sky, the Planck satellite is also measuring the polarization of the cosmic microwave background.
Hmm.
And they do have the data, but that data is more complicated to analyze, and so they're taking more time with it so that they get the answer right.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike, for your call. Cynthia in Madison, hi. Cynthia? There we go. Cynthia, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. Yes, I have a question about the 2012 Nobel Prize in Physics. I understand it talks about the transition from the quantum realm to more classical and gave us some information about decoherence. Could you tell me a little bit more about what was learned?
You're going to get me.
Okay. Well, then I have a follow-up.
Okay.
A different question.
Okay.
It has to do with what we're measuring with the Planck satellite and the realms of the very small and superstring theory. Are the superstring theory people really excited about what's coming through, and have there been any updates to some of the things that they were hoping to see?
Yeah, actually, that's one of the really interesting aspects of this whole story. So when superstring theory was first originated, the people involved in string theory were hoping to explain some of the properties of elementary particles. But with time, it became apparent, for reasons that I discussed before, that whatever it is that gave rise to the Big Bang probably had something to do with new high-energy physics, new particle physics. And so string theorists started to become very interested in cosmology, and they became very interested in inflation and very interested in these cosmic microwave background measurements. And over the past decade in particular, string theorists have developed a number of models for inflation that were quite elegant mathematically and very promising conceptually. And those models actually made predictions about the precise distribution of these fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. And now the Planck satellite measurements have come in and ruled out those models largely. So they were actually hoping to see certain statistical signatures in the cosmic microwave background data, and the statistical signatures that they were hoping to see were not seen. So it's starting to look like the simplest ideas that string theorists had for inflation are not working out.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah. I have a friend who's an experimentalist. And he said that if you do a measurement, if you spend many years of your life doing a measurement, you either want to discover something big, and if you don't discover something big, then you want to be able to really piss off some particular theorist. And the Planck satellite managed to do that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cynthia, for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking this hour about the images released, pictures from the Planck. And it is an international effort, really, 500 scientists all over the world, mostly Europe, but also in the United States and other places. And it was launched in 2009, has been scanning the sky ever since. And they've released some pictures that have shown us some very interesting things about the early formation of the universe, the Big Bang, about the expansion of the universe, and more. They're still analyzing the data from these pictures. Our guest, who is analyzing all of this with us, is a professor of physics and astronomy at Johns Hopkins University, Professor Mark Kamenyankowski. And we'll continue our phone calls and conversation with him in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, as people in America get older, we ask the question, are we prepared for old age and for long-term care? The answer, our guest will say, is no, and he will suggest what we can do as a society and also as individuals to make preparations to be vital and cared for and care for others as we get old. Back to phone calls now. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our lines have been really jammed, which is wonderful, but there are a couple openings right now, so if you've been frustrated, you will no longer be frustrated. Tim in Rhinelander, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Tim.
Hi. My question is regarding how distances in space is measured. You know, when you consider the fact that it's so far between known objects, and they're measured in light years. I was wondering if you use geometry to measure those distances, and how accurate do you feel those measurements are? Like, for example, angle, side angle, geometry, where you may have one known point on the East Coast, one known point on the West Coast. You know the distance between the two, and then you focus the telescope on whatever your object is in space, and then take an angle measurement. Is that how it's done, or is it done in some other manner?
Actually, that's a great question, and it's exactly how it's done. So, well, it's not exactly how it's done, but it's very close to how it's done. So the way that measurements are made in cosmology, there are a variety of techniques, but one of them, for example, is by observing the brightness of what we call a standard candle. So it turns out that there's a certain type of astrophysical phenomenon called a supernova. And a supernova is what happens when a star uses up all of its nuclear fuel. It no longer has any thermal energy to hold it up from gravitational collapse. It winds up falling in on itself and forming this huge explosion. And there are good reasons to believe, both from theory and from observations, that all supernovae have the same brightness. And so what we do, for example, is see how, they all have the same luminosity. They all emit the same amount of light. But if something is further away, then it will appear to be less bright. So we use the observed brightnesses of these supernovae to figure out how far away they are, and therefore how far the distance to the host galaxy that they reside in is.
Thanks very much for the call, Tim. Let's go to Steve in Mount Vernon next. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, good morning. I just wondered, as you get more precise in your calculations, if you have to deal with the relativity of time and also the gravitational forces on light as it approaches the Earth and the effects of our sun or other bodies?
Actually, that's a great question. The answer is yes and no. So all of our calculations that involve the cosmic microwave background are fundamentally relativistic. You have to have general relativity in order to model the phenomena. As far as deflection of light by the sun and the Earth, that does not really come into account. But cosmology, everything we do in cosmology, and especially the cosmic microwave background, really does require Einstein's general relativity. And in fact, the first notions that the universe might be expanding were one of the consequences of Einstein's relativity. you know, over close to 100 years ago.
Thank you, Steve, very much for the call. I was reading in news reports about Planck that, and I'm wondering if that we learned this from these pictures or if we've known this for a long time, but I never knew this, that all the things that we can see, the planets, the stars, as we look at the sky, make up only 4.9% of the universe. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
Goodness.
The things that we know about, you know, you and I and the sun and the earth are made out of electrons and protons and neutrons. But those electrons and protons and neutrons make up only about 5% of the matter in the universe. And about 20% of it is dark matter. And the rest of it is something called dark energy, which we have very little knowledge of, but we know must be there.
Hmm. So how do we find out about the dark energy?
The dark energy was actually discovered in 1998. The 2011 Nobel Prize went to the three of the scientists who led the experiments that discovered it. What they found by looking at supernovae, like I talked about before,
right,
is that the most distant supernovae were moving away from us more rapidly than they should. Put another way, if we look at two galaxies in the universe, they're not only moving away from each other, but they're moving away from each other with a velocity that's increasing. And that's extremely puzzling. If I throw a ball up in the air, it slows down, and eventually it reaches a maximum height, and then it comes back down to Earth. And that's because gravity is an attractive force. If I had a really good arm, I could throw a ball with a velocity so large that it would escape the gravitational field of the Earth and run off to infinity. But even in that case, the standard laws of gravity tell us that even if the ball were to fly away, it would always slow down. The velocity or speed at which it was moving away from the Earth would always decrease. And what we found through these observations back in 1998 is that galaxies don't follow these rules. Galaxies actually move apart from each other with increasing velocities. So it's almost as if there's some kind of anti-gravity going on cosmological for objects separated at cosmological distances.
Hmm.
It's extremely puzzling. We really don't understand why it's happening. Nobody really expected it. But the word we use to describe the phenomenon or the new physics that giving rise to it is dark energy.
Mm-hmm.
And like inflation, it's really a placeholder. We don't really understand the phenomenon. We can describe it, but we don't really understand it.
Mm-hmm. Steve, thanks for your call. One more call. Keith in Waukesha. Hi.
Hi. I had a question about the overall structure of the universe. If that satellite is picking up that. I heard galaxies were aligned in like streams or filaments. And also spiral galaxies were oriented in the same direction more often than not. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's actually pretty interesting. So one of the things that the Planck satellite did, amongst the many things, is actually discover filaments of galaxies and intergalactic gas that theorists had long postulated should exist based on numerical simulations. So what we do is we take the initial conditions for the universe that are seen in experiments like Planck or WMAPS, measurements of the cosmic microwave background. So we take those initial conditions and then we run them forward with simulations based on the known laws of physics, especially gravity. And when you do that, you find not only the galaxies form, but you also find that large clusters of galaxies form. And you also see in the simulations that the clusters of galaxies are sort of connected by filaments of galaxies and intergalactic gas. And one of the things that the Planck satellite did was actually observe some evidence for these filaments. The pictures are pretty nice. Unfortunately, it's a radio show, so I can't show them. But they're very, very pretty pictures that come from the simulations, and it looks like the observed that the real physical universe is starting to look like these simulations.
Thank you, Keith, so much for the call. Well, this has been fascinating hour. Thank you, Professor Kamienkowski, so much for being with us. It was great.
Sure. Thanks for letting me join you. It's a pleasure to talk about science.
I'm sure. Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Johns Hopkins University. Our guest this hour talking about what Planck gave us recently and discovering a little bit more about how it all began. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, Katie Madsen for on-air production in downtown Milwaukee, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We have news coming up momentarily. Stay with us. We're all getting older. We'll figure out how to do it better, second hour of our show.